The inception of these monologues began as a conversation between friends over dinner on Valentine's Day 2001. The idea was passed to the chairpersons organizing a symposium that spring in Northern California. Taking the idea and running with it, this compilation then developed into a call for monologues that culminated in a session at the 2001 Sunstone West Symposium in San Francisco on April 21st. Inspired by Eve Ensler's The Vagina Monologues, women from all across the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints were invited to submit monologues about their faith and sexuality. Our collective experiences discovering our sexuality, first-time sexual encounters, notions about sex, feelings about our bodies, relationships with men, relationships with women, living the law of chastity, not living the law of chastity, repenting of sexual misconduct, rejoicing in sexual liberation, are found here in this brave collection. The voices you will hear are poignant and honest. They are also angry, joyful, reflective, provocative, confused, and dynamic. In contributing to this work, each woman took a courageous step forward full of integrity. It has been my privilege to be involved in this anthology almost from the beginning. I rejoice in its inception, conception, and birth. Its reception has been astounding. As monologues were shared, we laughed and cried. We rose up in protest and in solidarity. We came away even more determined and driven to continue working toward a day when our church will shed its latent fear of sexuality and teach its members, especially its women, to rejoice in their sentience, to embrace intimacy without the scourge of polarizing it between sinful and not sinful, and to own their bodies in an act of powerful, uplifting freedom. Married or single, widowed or divorced, straight or gay, abused or nurtured, temple marriage or civil union, they have all come together here and in one voice proclaimed their sacred space. So I think we'll start out with Janet's own piece, Sun Kissed. That's short, and then we will go to Donna. Janet has an MA in Religion and Society from the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Her area of specialization is Mormon culture and life. In addition to her fascination with the need religion fills in the lives of individuals, she wrote this herself, by the way. She is also a consummate cook and prolific writer. She is a very good cook. I've eaten her cooking. So, Kirsten will read that for you. And this is my sister-in-law, Kirsten Anderson.
It's hot out today. I'm sitting in the sun, sweating in my swimming suit. A moment ago, I thought, I'd love to take my suit off, and I'd be perfectly comfortable sitting out here topless. Then I realized the people with views from the buildings around me might not be comfortable with me and my breasts enjoying the sun. Of course, I'm assuming my breasts would enjoy the sun, but I didn't ask them. So where did I learn to be so brazen? Actually, I don't think it's about being brazen. I think it's about learning to be comfortable with my physical self. I realize a part of my comfort comes from having been in a relationship with someone that included physical intimacy. Some of it comes from Grandma explaining that the body is God's finest artwork, a heavenly masterpiece. Some of it comes from studying the anatomy of the body and being awed by its universe. And some of it comes from realizing that modesty, although a good and needful value, can be carried to an extreme, which translates into fear. And I'm tired of and don't want any part of that fear anymore. Fear of what? Fear of what we are? Sentient, beautifully sculpted, wonderfully made, a physical marvel, a mechanical wonder, a recreative miracle. We are simple in form and content, exquisitely intricate. And yet, too many of us are too uncomfortable with the simple act of sharing the sun with our breasts, of being what we have been created to be, a masterpiece of universal awe and intricacy blending into the unclothed, landscaped, unclothed.
Next, we will have a piece by Patricia Hendricks called Please, Please, Please. She is a mother of six children, one daughter and five sons. Her youngest son started kindergarten, and her oldest daughter started college this fall. I don't know if this was last fall. Patricia has found that there are a lot of similarities in these new beginnings. Patricia's family all occasionally congregate together in their home in Media, Pennsylvania, especially between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. Patricia is a coordinator for the Temple University Center for Research in Human Development and Education, a lifelong member of the church. Patricia currently serves as the nursery leader in her home ward. She says writing this monologue was cathartic, therapeutic, and painful. I don't know what kind of church we live in that calls a mother of six to be the nursery leader. Don't you think she needs a break? That's read by Donna.
My sexuality, perhaps my experience as a woman, can be summed up in my desire to please. I can see myself as a young bride, a suppliant, thin 20-year-old, riding in a car with my new husband on our way home from the temple. The ceremony was over. The evening reception awaited, and we were driving towards a 5-hour black hole that my mother refused to plan, orchestrate, or even consider. In the car, my new husband slowly laid his hand along my back and then hesitantly crept his fingers down, down, and inside my dress. He and I were both afraid of what he might find hiding under the dress, slip, bra, and garments. Later in the hotel room, I went into the bathroom to change, but I didn't know what to change into. I was so young and very virginal. I had lived the law of chastity to the letter. I didn't even watch R-rated movies. Before marriage, I let my husband's returned missionary conscience control how much necking would go on. I wanted him to want me and was a bit confused by the stories in young women's lessons about having to control boys because they wouldn't control themselves. I just never found those boys, I guess. The boys I dated before I was 19 never tried to do more than I wanted. In fact, they tried less. While living at home, I shared a bedroom and bathroom with a sister 13 months older than me. I often watched her apply toothpaste and other concoctions to hickeys on her neck and chest. I told myself I didn't want that. I was saving myself for my spouse. I was taught and I believed that I was some sort of commodity that I would present to this mythical white knight. So on my wedding day, while he was changing in the hotel bathroom, I decided to please my new spouse. I wanted to have sex with him. I just didn't know how to go about it. I came out of the bathroom dressed in my robe. He began untying the tight bands around my waist and gawked in amazement and credulity that I was still wearing a slip, a bra, pantyhose, and garments. He teased, "What did you take off?" I had replaced my dress with my bathroom, so essentially I was still dressed. I was so ashamed. Just recently, my 19-year-old daughter and I were discussing Britney Spears. She defended Britney's right to dress as sexually as she desired. I suggested that young boys like her 10-year-old brother loved Britney Spears, and perhaps she should take the age of her fans into consideration when choosing her wardrobe. My daughter quoted Britney as saying, "I dress for me, not for them." I wonder what would have happened in my life if I had had the right to be a sexual being instead of a gift that was given to a sexual being. The shame of our first sexual encounter drove me to try harder to please. I became the Energizer Bunny. I kept going and going, nothing diminishing my anytime, anywhere motto. If he wanted it, he got it, whether I was suffering from raging bladder infections, bulging pregnancy, flu, finals, or whatever. I was the go girl. Or should I say, go-go girl? My husband's obnoxious conservative attitude reinforced and perpetuated my needs to please. As young newlyweds, we attended a BYU fireside on sexuality. During the Q&A, the male speaker suggested that anything sexual was okay between a husband and his wife, and as long as it ended in ejaculation. My husband and I discussed the ideas presented that night and decided this was true. I had my litmus test, my need to please, my rubric of assessment. What more could a young bride need? Our first child was born 6 days before our first wedding anniversary. The doctor miscalculated the due date. He thought she was 3 weeks overdue and broke my water on December 24th. However, without the water to cushion the contractions, the cord wrapped around her neck and compromised the amount of oxygen my baby received in utero. To save her life, the doctor entered my vagina with forceps and yanked the baby out. The excruciating labor and delivery ended, and we had a 5-pound girl. After the neonatal nurses whisked her off to the preemie nursery, the doctor began the arduous task of sewing me up. He spent over an hour stitching my torn uterus and surrounding tissues. I couldn't sit comfortably for several months, and I experienced terrible backaches for years. But on my husband's 22nd birthday, 3 weeks later, I bought a slinky, sexy teddy as a birthday present. I was really going to atone for all the clothing I wore on our wedding afternoon. I enticed him and encouraged him. I masked the O's of the sore stitches with the awe of sexual pleasure. I wonder if he ever really knew what that afternoon cost me. I raped myself with an incredible need to please him. I spent 14 more years trying to please him without ever considering the personal cost. We had 6 children, so I was pregnant or nursing for 12 of these years. He was in graduate school, aka never home, for 8 of these years. During our moves from Utah to Georgia and Georgia to Michigan, the biggest burden I carried was my need to please. Finally, just following the birth of our 6th child, my husband was diagnosed with MS, multiple sclerosis. In order to save his brain from a fatal accumulation of scar tissue, he began taking injections of beta interferon. The drug ravaged his body for 3 months until his body learned to accept it. He injected himself every other evening and then would climb wearily into bed to await the chills, nausea, and other terrible drug-induced distress. Along with losing his good humor, he lost his ability to have an erection. I couldn't please him. I could no longer pass the litmus test. He left me a few weeks later. He immediately began an intimate relationship with his 26-year-old graduate student. Apparently, the return of his erection coincided with his body accepting the drugs. In one of the many frantic and tear-stained encounters that accompanied our uncoupling, he snipped, "You make me impotent." I spent 4 years trying to pull myself together. Throughout my grief, I've cried and berated in the air, "But what about me? Did you ever consider how you made me feel?" But of course, it wasn't in our litmus. My orgasm just didn't matter. It was a non-essential byproduct of sexuality. One time during a recent blind date, I decided that my sexuality did matter. I decided that I was a sexual being and God created me as one, and I didn't need permission to act like one. I had sexual feelings and I didn't need to apologize for them. So when a Brazilian sucked my fingers, I went into his bathroom and took off all my clothes, garments included. His eyes exploded when I walked out without a single stitch on. I felt so sexy. I felt like a woman, sisters with Britney and Shania. Sagging breasts, 20 pounds, and stretch marks notwithstanding. Throughout the relationship, I told myself that I was a sexual being and that I could pursue my needs, feelings, and desires. However, I didn't. I listened to his divorce woes, his girlfriend woes, his money woes. I cooked for him and wrote his resume. Although I told myself I was going to his house for romps to please me and discover my own sexuality, all I really was doing was feeding my need to please. This all became overly apparent when one day when he was begging for a blowjob, I asked, "Well, what will you do for me?" He looked me right in the face and said, "I'll take a shower first." I laughed deeply and heartily, gathered my clothes, and left. I never returned any of his phone calls. 6 weeks later, I sat in the bishop's office to confess. I was embarrassed, humble, and halting. He was kind, a bit full of himself, but patient. I think my confession pleased him.
Thanks, Donna. That was great. I heard it read by somebody else last year. I have never met Patricia Hendricks, and I have no idea what she'd be like. I've gotten a completely different idea of her 2 different times from having 2 different people read her paper. Next will be Angela Campbell reading a piece she wrote called The Body, B-A-W-D-Y. And, oh, I should do the little introduction thing. I don't know if you wrote this or if Janet wrote it. Angela Campbell has a B.S. in human biology from Stanford and an M.A. in education also from Stanford. She's been teaching biology and chemistry for the past 5 years at Pasadena High School, and this year added physics, or last year?
2 years now.
Yeah. 2 years, yeah. Angela served a Spanish-speaking mission in Houston, Texas from August 1989 to December 1990. She was married to Chris Campbell in the Portland Temple in 1991 and divorced in 1996. She married Lee Polson in 1999. Angela joined the church in 1986, just before going to Stanford as an undergrad, and as a result of years of praying for the gift of the Holy Ghost. She was raised as a born-again Christian in Sunnyside, Washington. Her first introduction to the church was a Sunday evening service at the Church of God, in which she watched the movie The Godmakers.
All too true. The body. I'm in Paris with my husband of less than a year, and we're wandering around the Arc de Triomphe. I'm thinking, what amazing architecture. The flowers are carved with such detail. What an amazing honor for some unknown soldier. My husband says to me, there are breasts and penises poking out everywhere. I'm amused and slightly embarrassed, hoping no one around us understands English. I was not raised Mormon, but it doesn't matter that much. I was raised American. I was raised Christian. I was more than a little embarrassed about nakedness from the time I was old enough to recognize what it was. My first trip to Europe happened when I was 17, and I kept marveling at the nude and scantily clad statues I saw all over buildings and in museums. Even respectable places like the Vatican and public libraries sported images of naked human bodies. I wonder if the Puritans were all ugly. Were they fat or wiry, hairy people who hated the sight of their own nakedness? I mean, most of the people who first colonized this country were from Europe, where those nude statues have been lurking about for centuries. Did the founding fathers and mothers leave home because of the statues? Why don't the public libraries in our country have naked humans for adornment? So I went to India 4 years ago. Talk about an ancient civilization. Most of the art I saw on their buildings and temples predated Buddhism. They had all kinds of naked people. They even have temples in Khajuraho with depictions of sex positions known as the Kama Sutra carved all over the outside of the building where any man, woman, or child can see. Some of these positions are hard to imagine getting into without help. In fact, there seem to be servants involved in holding the participants in position. I wonder if the artisans were using live models as they carved. I wonder who funded the building project. My guess is he had a Y chromosome. How is it that what is viewed on one side of the globe as art, as something beautiful enough to adorn holy temples and civic buildings, is relegated to the status of pornography on my side of the globe? Pin-up girls in lockers at school and in the bathrooms at taverns are about as decorative as the human body gets in America. Is it any wonder that sales of nudie magazines are so much higher over here than over there? They can see beautiful naked people at church or on the subway. I have to sneak illicit peeks in magazines. I remember the first time I saw a Playboy magazine. I was 9 years old, and it was sitting there in the laundry room of the apartment complex where I lived. My sister and I would sit next to the dryer vent and keep warm while it rained outside, and we would examine the pictures in the magazine. Would we look like these women someday? Is this what men found desirable? How come everyone's skin always looks wet in these pictures? Now, I am a committed subscriber to Cosmopolitan magazine. My other favorite is Better Homes and Gardens. I read them both regularly. I find the pictures in Cosmo to be liberating and enticing. I'm a goal-oriented person, so it's easy for me to try for skin as clear as this model or a butt as tight as that actress. Cosmo gives me a standard of outer beauty to strive for, and I really like the articles. I am not saying that I think Mormons are uptight about the human body. I'm saying that I think Americans are uptight, and that in particular, the Puritan Christian tradition in this country has created shame and secrecy around something so natural and normal as my own flesh. I like my breasts. The left one is exactly 1.25 inches higher than the right one. And the right one is bigger and heavier than the left one. This causes my right shoulder to sag just slightly. These soft, pillowy bags of flesh that grew out of my flat childhood chest are mine. I like to look at them. They feel interesting. I enjoy all the nerve endings in them, especially in the areola and nipple. I don't have any children yet. 3 more months. And breasts do not typically invoke maternal images for me. I see them as beautiful, womanly things that are sensual and comforting. I found out in my early 20s that I'm attracted to the female form. When I see a woman with a pleasing figure, I catch myself studying her as I would a perfect tulip or a stunning Van Gogh or Monet. I already knew that I liked the male form, although I never wanted pictures of naked men around. But I find the female form to be beautiful and desirable. I love the curves and the softness of the skin. I like the beauty I see in female faces and the texture of feminine hair. During my first marriage, I learned how to really enjoy sex. I learned that letting myself enjoy every inch of my lover's body and letting myself be appreciated in the same way was immensely satisfying. I like my breasts, and if he likes them too, I can tell he's enjoying them, I feel fulfilled. Very few people know my nakedness. As you can tell, man, look at all the clothes I was wearing. I guard it so carefully. I wish I did not fear what others thought of or desired of my body. I wish my natural form was not seen as bawdy or sinful in the eyes of my neighbors. But I'm not planning to move to Europe either.
Thanks, Angela. Now we're going to hear a piece called My Name is Sarah and I Am. I think I gave it to Gloria. Sarah, Paula Marie Sanderson, lives in Preston, England, and has been a member of the church for about 5 years. And this introduction is terribly outdated. It says she met her life partner and eternal companion through an online list for Mormon lesbians, and that she would be moving to California last year. Well, she didn't move to California, and I'm not sure they're still together. But it's worth a try. At least they met on a Mormon list for lesbians, which I think is great. So this is, my name is Sarah, and I am, and it will be read by Gloria Manning Smee.
It's not often that you get an opportunity to talk like this, truthfully, without having to censor what you say. My bishop isn't going to see this, is he? I am a little scared, to tell you the truth. Scared of being given this open mic, so to speak. I don't know what's going to come out. I am a gay Mormon woman. I am aware of what you must be thinking. Trust me, I am. The questions going round in your head when you hear the word gay Mormon, believe me, I have thought about all of them. But I'm going to talk anyway, and I hope you listen without judging. I have had these feelings all my life. I have never talked to a shrink before, never been in therapy. I was 17 when I finally realized or accepted the fact that I was gay. I say realize because looking back, I had always been this way. I just didn't realize sooner. I had never considered the fact that I could be. I don't know. I just know that my mind was really very confused, and I thought I could suppress my sexuality or cure myself. What was I thinking? So I played the little hetero girl, editing my language and trying to control my thoughts and my body, trying to imagine getting married to a man and living happily ever after. I had always imagined myself married, but not now, it seemed. I was the good little Mormon girl, going to church and being good, moving the work forward, keeping new converts on the straight and narrow. I loved my church, but I loved women too, instead of men. For the first time in my life, I now have a sense of all the injustice in the world. I see how people discriminate for pitiful reasons, race, sex, gender, sexuality, whereas before I just knew about it. Now it is personal, and I encounter it everywhere. Now I am being discriminated against by governments and most people around me. I feel like a second-class citizen. It makes me question who I am. It makes me wonder what my relationship is with the Savior and our Heavenly Father and with everyone else around me. My mom is the only one in my family who knows, and she says she doesn't mind gay people. But why do they have to introduce themselves as being gay? Like, hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm gay. How many of us actually do that? My answer to that is, if I did not point that out to you, you probably would assume I am straight. I hear you asking, well, why is that so bad? Because I am not. Never have been, never will be. How do I know I am a homosexual? Well, how do you know that you're a heterosexual? Is it just who you are attracted to, mind, body, soul, spirit? Who you get on with? I don't like the word sexuality. It brings up all kinds of bad words for me, few of which are what it is to me. Bodily appetites, desire, eroticism, lust, sensuality, and sexiness. All of these are true, but my sexuality is not just these. Yet people always think immediately about sex when they hear that I am gay. Sexuality is also about love, bonds, friendship, companionship. Of course, sex is a part of it. It isn't any long-term committed relationship, which is the hardest thing about being gay and Mormon, being told that I break the law of chastity. If I could marry my girlfriend, then we would have waited. It breaks our hearts that we cannot marry civilly or in the temple. Our love is no less special or valid because we are two women, two sisters in the gospel. Why do I want marriage? Don't most good Mormon people? I have been conditioned by normal society to want marriage. It is something that I have always looked forward to. I only became a member at 17, so really all of my ideas about the world were formed before then. A lot of them were just built upon by gospel standards. As a result, my view of marriage, is it a total commitment to each other forever? It is about family, chastity, monogamy, faith, hope, and love. Still, as a lesbian Mormon, my mind is now going in different directions because all that I have dreamed is being denied. I can't possibly achieve my dreams as they stand. I can have them to a degree, but not in total. I can have a normal life with my life partner in our own home, but not outside it. I don't feel any different about myself than you probably feel about yourself, not on the outside or on the inside. I am not my sexuality. I am a daughter of my Heavenly Father, and He loves me. He knows me. My name is Sarah, and I am.
Thanks, Gloria. Our next piece will be On Marrying After One's Youth by Janet Brigham Rands, who I'm very sad is not here today because I absolutely adore her. Janet Brigham lives with her husband, Richard Rands, and her now one cat in Mountain View, California, a research psychologist at SRI International Menlo Park, specializing in tobacco dependence. She worked as a journalist and editor for more than a decade before venturing into the discipline of behavioral research. She worked at the Ensign for a long time. Boy, the stories she can tell you. Anyway, Janet's piece will be read by Jan Irie.
I think you said she was 47 when this.
She got married.
That's how old I am. Oh, right now. So I can kind of relate to this. It has always seemed so easy for some people to get married and have children. Somehow there's no question that they'll get engaged and have a lovely wedding. Then they'll go on to have at least several children. The daughter of a friend of mine who died of breast cancer 2 years ago wrote me this week to let me know she's pregnant. She said she thinks she'll miss her mother more than ever now that she's having her first pregnancy and her first child. I doubt that getting married and having a child seems easy to someone who misses her mother, her best friend, almost every moment of every day. I miss her mother, too. Her life was so much more emotionally interesting than mine. Marriage came easily to her. So easily, in fact, that she was married several times. In those marriages, she had three children. She finally gave up marrying after the fourth marriage ended and just lived with the last partner, the last one before she died. She never wrote of him as if he were a lover, but instead she told me what fine care he took of her as she went through round after round of chemotherapy and surgery. She tried for several years to eradicate the cancer that finally took her. I talked to that last partner after her funeral. He hadn't slept for days, or perhaps for months or years, and was close to hysteria. He later sent me several photos of her with her last child, most of them taken with the spectacular backdrop of Zion's Park, with a little boy riding piggyback in a blue nylon and aluminum carrier on her back. My friend had called me when she was 42 and pregnant with that little boy. She'd just married number four, who was many years younger than she. I remember she chuckled and said she hoped these old bones had enough life left in them for her to make it through the pregnancy. She had no idea, in the innocence of her relative youth, that she would survive the pregnancy, but not the boy's childhood. While she had the marriages and children, I carried around the same reproductive equipment, but didn't use it. Sometimes I fantasized that it would be more convenient if I could just detach it like a computer peripheral and plug it back in should I happen to need it. That would certainly reduce the risk of cancer. A few months before my friend died, I wrote to tell her I was getting married. I asked her if she had any advice, since she'd had more experience getting married than I had. She wrote back and said to not worry about not being ready to get married, because a person is never ready to get married. And she said to throw myself into it with abandon and to give it everything I had. So, relatively ancient bride that I was, I did that. She apologized for not being able to come to the wedding, but said she was mostly in the hospital those days. She died less than 2 months after my wedding. Her daughter spent many days at her bedside at the end, and now the daughter wishes that her mother could be there to reverse these roles. I used to think that love was the software in our lives, that we could install one person, and if things didn't work out, we could uninstall that person and install another person. But now I know that love is the hardware. Once it's installed, we are forever changed, and we must never, never be the same again. I told my husband tonight that I'm glad that we are making some recreational use of all that reproductive equipment that I've hauled around for all those years. In our decidedly middle-aged lives, it's not the use that most people think nature intended it for, I'm sure. But who are we to guess what nature intends?
Thanks, Jeff. Next, we're going to hear a piece called From Victoria's Secret to Beehive Clothing, written by Sylvia Cabas. And Sylvia Cabas works for Catholic Relief Services in Morocco, where she specializes in developing gender-responsive programming and policies. She's the only member of the church in Morocco. So before she left, she was in Nairobi at the time. She wrote to me and had me buy like every Mormon book I could think of, and so she would have be able to do her kind of own Sunday Mormon time kind of thing. At the time she wrote this article, she was in Nairobi. And this article originally appeared in the Fall 1999 Exponent 2 and is reprinted here with permission. Oh, she joined. Oh, I think she probably tells us the name. So Kirsten will read this.
Garments. I used to see them all the time in a combination of voyeurism on my part and exhibitionism on their part. They'd peek out from under two short Bermuda shorts. They'd flash under skirts when legs were crossed. They'd even show under collars when a handbag strap pulled the wrong way. They marked endowed members, distinguished them from mere recent converts like myself. Even as a baptized, tithe-paying member, I did not feel like a real Mormon. I hadn't served a mission and seemed unlikely to, since my 2 years as a Peace Corps volunteer probably counted as a secular mission for the U.S. government. Even as a tool of American foreign policy, not much was expected of me. If I was often mistaken for a nun, it was because I had to adopt over-the-knee skirts in order not to be mistaken for a prostitute. I am an overeducated, single, bi-coastal Mormon. I study gender and international development in graduate school. I don't have a perm. I'm an alumni of UC Berkeley, the great Satan of universities. My only time in Utah consists of one weekend trip. I don't have a Franklin planner. I've never read Stephen Covey. I have no experience with resin grapes or green jello. I turned down a full scholarship to BYU for graduate school, even though I was told that I could get married there. That was before I was informed that it had already been priced out of the Utah marriage market. Admittedly, I have a collection of flower dresses, some even with matching hair accessories. Then again, I was told I couldn't wear pants to church. I do now, however, wear garments. My life as a convert followed the same basic pattern: baptism, patriarchal blessing, endowment, perhaps marriage and family to anticipate as well. I knew that I would be going to the temple upon my 1 year anniversary as a Mormon, and consequently my lingerie days would be over. No more annual shopping trips to Victoria's Secrets on Valentine's Day for me. During my first year after my baptism, I went through a major transition. Summer in Montreal, I attend the French-speaking ward and take advantage of the exchange rate and the August sale to buy an impressive array of lingerie. Autumn in D.C., I get my first real look at garments in a shared dressing room at JCPenney with a friend from the ward. They look innocuous and sedate. I start taking the temple prep courses and read a couple of books on the subject. I experience my first encounter with oblique discourse surrounding the temple. I remain confused. To gain a cross-cultural perspective on social change, I read an essay on veiling practices of Muslim women in Bali. I think I'm beginning to understand. Winter. Not until the evening before, as my escort and I are chatting, am I informed of the game plan for the next day. She and I have the ceremonial laying away of the lingerie. As I take out each item, she oohs and ahs in admiration. I fold them neatly into a Talbot's bag, now relegated to Closet Siberia. Spring. The day of my endowment, I wear my favorite black and white zebra-striped undies under the most Molly Mormon dress I own. I pray fervently that Mormons inside temples do not possess x-ray vision. My first pair, dry silk, baggy. I have a hard time pulling on my pantyhose afterwards. the distribution center, a madhouse on a Sunday, Saturday afternoon. I hurriedly finger the fabric samples and decide on the poly cottons. I'm told to order more through the toll-free number. I go home and try on all my questionable clothes. Most can stay. A couple of short skirts and dresses have to go. That evening, I go to a dance party. I feel the extra layer keenly and wonder if anyone else notices. While I had been taking the missionary discussions, I'd bought a dress with the money I would have spent on the latest in reproductive technology. I can no longer wear this dress because of my garments. In an attempt at bravery, I wear thigh-high stockings to work. They roll down as I walk down the hallway towards my boss, and I expose myself as I tug them up afterwards. On the phone, my mother mentions seeing Steve Young on TV and wonders if he wears the funny underwear he had talked about on 60 Minutes. I miss a golden chance to explain. I am now the proud owner of a 2-week supply. I only wear white bras these days. I have a favorite fabric and style of garment. I still feel them, but in a comfortable rather than constricting sense. I feel naked without them. I am naked without them.
Thanks, Kirsten. Now we'll hear one of my favorite pieces by Mary Ellen Robertson called New Testament 101. And Mary Ellen, let's see. Janet must have written this, not you, I think, too. I think for those of us who she knew, she just kind of went and wrote the own bios by herself. Mary Ellen Robertson has a penchant for interesting jewelry, frog paraphernalia, good food, and spirited discussion. She has an MA in Women's Studies and Religion from the Claremont Graduate School. She believes that if the Book of Mormon were made into a movie, its rating would preclude most Mormons from going to see it.
My parents are safely ensconced in another session, so I don't have to worry about Mom walking in and hearing more than I would volunteer. This piece is called New Testament 101. Almost everything I needed to know about female masturbation I learned in a BYU religion class. It was a New Testament class held in one of those fan-shaped rooms in the Eyring Science Center, the same room where I had Biology 101 and Physical Science. The professor was an energetic, white-haired, bespectacled guy whose detractors said he was running for general authority. He told entertaining stories about his big family and had students who came from big families stand and tell how many siblings they had. With only one sibling, my family was apparently beneath notice. While some of the professor's stories were entertaining, I found it unfair that some of these stories found their way onto our exams. Rather than limiting test matter to the New Testament, the professor asked questions about a friend's dream about a cyclops he told the class about. I thought it was a chicken shit way of making sure we showed up and stayed awake. I don't know how we got on the subject, but one day in class, the professor started talking about some of his experiences as a bishop or counselor. He described a situation in which a woman in his ward, or maybe a student in his class, I don't remember which, came to him and described a problem she had. She masturbated. I remember being a little surprised that the professor was talking about a woman masturbating. Wasn't it far more likely that the men he counseled had more of a problem with that, if that's a problem? It didn't really even occur to me that women could or did masturbate until then. I looked around the room. Was anyone else finding this story astonishing? I couldn't tell. The professor spoke at length about this, describing the weekly counseling sessions he had with this woman. He had asked whether she'd been able to refrain from masturbating or touching herself during the past week. Sometimes the answer was yes. More often it seemed it was no. He would tell her about the horrors of this habit. I don't know if he described like hair growing on palms or anything, but he read scriptures. He read the miracle of forgiveness at her in an attempt to dissuade her from masturbating. I couldn't help but think it was inappropriate for the professor to be telling 80 of us New Testament students about what seemed to be an excruciatingly personal matter. He said she eventually stopped masturbating after many sessions spent in his office discussing the issue with him. I wondered, did she really stop? Or did she just stop telling him? I figured she lied to him and kept right on doing it, but maybe I'm projecting. And how did she figure out how to masturbate in the first place? I was a late bloomer in that respect, even though I'd gotten a heads up about women being able to masturbate, thanks to New Testament class. I didn't rush right home and try it for myself. I don't know why I didn't. A few years later, I met up with a guy who was able to bring me to orgasm, unlike the awkward fumblings of the BYU boys I dated. When we broke up, I missed the new sensation of orgasm and decided to give it a go myself. And I've been a do-it-yourself gal ever since. It might seem odd, but I'd like to thank that BYU religion professor for being the first to let me know that women, too, can masturbate. And I'd like to thank that former boyfriend for beating a hasty retreat so that I could, somewhat out of spite, learn to appreciate the art of going solo.
Now we will hear a piece that was written anonymously. The pseudonym is Tamara Jane Collins, and the piece is called Coming of Age in America. And it will be read by...
Frances K. Oliver.
Okay. Frances K. Oliver.
Volunteered last minute. I was 10 years old, and it was my first babysitting job. My aunt had recommended me to some people in her ward. They had a baby boy named Alex. I gathered my school books and sweater and set them in front of the door, waiting for the dad to pick me up. My own dad came in, drunk as was usual on Friday nights.
"Where the hell are you going?"
he drawled. "I'm babysitting tonight for some friends of Auntie Susan. I studied the toes of my sneakers.
"Fuck, do these people know how old you are?"
"Yeah, I think so. Mom said it was okay." There was a knock on the door. When Daddy opened it, we both looked up at a gigantic, blonde man mountain. He boomed.
"You must be Tamara. I'm Leon Waring."
He turned to my dad and made a few polite comments about not having me out too late. My visual memory of this is that the man stood over Dad by more than a foot and was at least that much wider across his chest. I was terrified of Dad. He left enough physical and emotional scars on me to keep me cowering from him and other men until well into my 20s. So this huge man seemed like a Goliath to me. 12. On the way home from babysitting, now 2-year-old Alec and his baby brother, Brett, Mr. Waring tells me, "You know you can tell me anything. I hope you know that I feel close to you, that I wouldn't let anyone hurt you." I cried in my room for over an hour that night. No one asked why. 13. "I love you, not like a child. You're too mature for that. I love you like a grown woman. The kids think of you like another mother. I could crush your father's skull between my bare hands like a melon. That man's just a bully." My grades dropped. My chest grew. My writing stopped. I was afraid to babysit and afraid to say no. It was around this time that I remember my dad saying, There isn't such thing as rape. That just means the woman feels bad about it later." Then he would laugh and laugh. He often made me change my top before I went to school. "That's too damn tight, Elaine," he'd say to my mom. "Is a girl her age supposed to have tits like that? Maybe she ought to go to see a doctor." No sweater was baggy enough. 14. He held his hand over my mouth and said, "If you scream, you'll scare the boys. You don't want to scream. I don't want to have to knock you out and tell them that you're just asleep either, so don't tell, okay?" He had come home without his wife, telling her that he didn't feel well. It wasn't the first time he'd done something like this, but it was memorable because he raped me, then drove me home. During the drive, he told me how good it was and how glad he was that he was my first. He then said something I had never been able to wipe from my memory. "A girl never forgets her first time." I don't like to look back at all of that. Suicidal thoughts and years of depression followed. I developed a deep love of hot baths, very hot. I would bathe 2 or 4 times a day, turning my skin a pale pink each time, and soaking until my skin wrinkled and my fingernails softened. I still prefer a bath being quite hot. 25. My virginal Mormon husband tells me that he's glad one of us has some experience. Actually, in 11 years, I gained a wealth of experience. The thing about most men is that they think yes means yes, maybe means yes, and no means I like rough sex. At least that's how I felt at 25. I know that now that unhealthy people gravitate towards one another like magnets. 30. Mrs. Collins, we had to remove the remaining tube. I'm sorry. You could still get pregnant through in vitro fertilization if more children will be very important to you. The surgeon looked like a Boy Scout. He had done a wonderful job removing my second ruptured ectopic pregnancy. Two boys in between. The visitors to my hospital room told me how lucky I am to have survived the medical emergency. They tell me to focus on the children I already have. My own mother says, well, you should feel fortunate. Some women can't ever have children. I grieve for the baby girl I'll never have. 33. My kindergartner now asks how babies get into mommy's tummies. After a picture book and a long afternoon of new words and strange explanations, his question is, will you and Daddy do it again, Mommy? We really need another baby in our family. I cry myself to sleep after everyone's bathed and fed, just like I did after my first babysitting job when I was 10 years old.
Thanks. The next piece was written by Yvette Hansen, who I wish could have been here. She was here last year. And it's called Bear. Yvette Hansen is a mother of three. She lives in Reno, Nevada with her husband and children, where she's a stay-at-home mom who homeschools her children.
I perceived this as naivety on his part. He seemed so oblivious to the way of the rest of the world had seen these things. Our wedding night, lovely hotel room overlooking a lake. I had something pretty and feminine I had picked up the previous afternoon, knowing he had waited a long time for this. Not wanting him to be too disappointed because I hadn't. When all was said and done, he leaped out of bed and ran into the bathroom. Odd. Then I heard the shower running. Also odd, since he hadn't just gone to sleep. He emerged from the bathroom wearing the same pair of garments he had been wearing all day long. Why do you have your garments back on, sweetheart? I asked. I was met with silence. He lay down beside me. Honey, I asked, is this a signal that you're tired now or what? Again, only silence. This became a pattern. He would always rush to wash and then return to his garments after our lovemaking. It gave me the feeling that he needed to clean all traces of me from himself, and then, in order to sleep soundly, he needed to replace his protective garments. For 4 years, I never slept in the arms of my husband or felt his bare chest under my cheek. There was always white cotton between us. After my first foray through the temple on our first anniversary, I refused to wear my garments during the night after lovemaking. Perhaps I resented it, and it was the only way to voice my anger. Last year, I stopped wearing garments altogether. A few months later, so did he. I like pretty, pale-colored underwear that's lacy and designed to be pretty. He likes to sleep naked. When we've made love, and when we haven't.
Thanks, Sally. And next we will have a piece called Balance by Haley Lee. I can't remember who I asked to read this one. There you go. By Layla Key. Oh, sorry. I should read about Haley Lee. I don't know her. Haley Lee is a 48-year-old mother of five. She's been married for 25 years and has five grandchildren. A lifelong member of the church, Haley recently had her name removed from church records. She lives in Utah County.
She's 48, so you have to subtract a few years from me. I think I've finally figured it out. I need to feel sexual/sensual to feel soft. My life has been so full of needing to be tough, hard, steel hard. When I don't have those soft moments in my life, moments of giving in, vulnerability, letting loose, I am unbalanced. I remain too hard. I'm a teen. My life is full of opposite ends of the scale. By night, I am a member of a Mormon family, one of eight children. Dad's in the bishopric. Mom's in the Relief Society. During the day, I am with the most entertaining and enlightening group of kids I have ever met. We smoke marijuana and have sex. Oh, how I love the feel of those boys' hands on my body. I love kissing. On Sundays, I teach the sunbeams. During the week, I rationalize that I am beyond rules, beyond the establishment, free love. But where does one so young put those duplicitous feelings? My mind, heart, must have begun the hardening process. I go to BYU because that's the only place my father will pay my tuition. I get pregnant. My hippie side wants to run back east and raise the child. My Mormon side wins by giving him away. Steal. I don't even cry. I go back to BYU. I go to the Personal Development Center for a little postpartum therapy. All anyone ever wants to talk about is that I got pregnant, not why. I find a cute return missionary. He's a wonderful kisser. How incredible to have hands on my body again. He takes me to his apartment where his roommates are not home, undresses me. Are we going to have sex? Wait, he's an RM. Surely we'll only cuddle. Nope. His garments are off and it's over before I can even breathe. I vow to never date again. Steal. Okay, so I do date again. But I'm terribly cautious, always guarded. I marry in the Provo Temple. I marry a very nice, kind man. I know he will give my soft side the boost it needs. Four children later, I have had some of the most wonderfully sensuous years of my life. Nothing can compare to those soft little heads nuzzled to a breast. Nothing. I breastfeed them all for record years. Meantime, I hardly notice that my nice, kind husband gets very little of my sexual / sensual side as he slides further into depression. The mommy track is almost over. The last babe is sipping his last milk. I begin to notice a definite sensual void in my life. Is that what that guy over there was for? How long has it been since we made love? Months? Years? Kids grow and we experience more than our share of trials. Or does everyone feel that way? I try to reach out to this stranger, my husband, and realize he is far gone. I find I am made of the hardest steel, nothing to soften me. I crave sweet kisses. I crave the touch of hands caressing my body. I need to be vulnerable somewhere. I am the pivot point for almost everyone in my life. My faith is leaving me. I look to the heavens for any answer at all and get nothing. Nothing. I beg, where is this eternal marriage I've been told about all my life? Where is the companionship I should have earned by staying here for the last 25 years? I can't find it. I am struggling to fill that void. I know I have this deep, deep need inside my head, my heart, my body. I tell the universe I am ready to have those needs met. I know it will not happen in my marriage. I open my heart, my eyes, heart. I open my life. Can I kiss you? I jump off the cliff of no return and fall into the sweetest kiss of my life. The warmest embrace, the softest of touch. I fill the void. The steel is molten, the passion keen. No regrets. You see, I have figured out, have it figured out now. It's about balance.
Thanks, Lyle. Our next piece is by, I don't know if it's Lorelei or Lorelei. Do you know her, Marielle? Lorelei Kay. She was actively involved in the church for 50 years, but since discovering that women actually have value, she made a new choice and now worships with those who have similar beliefs. I didn't write this. Surviving a temple marriage of 25 years, she is presently blissfully single. And her piece is called The Glory of God is Pleasing Your Husband. And it will be read by Kirsten Wald.
When I was a young bride, some 30 years ago, I was very eager to be a good wife and also be true to all the teachings of the church. I made an appointment with my bishop, a very kind and loving man, for my temple recommend. I was concerned about my husband's interest in oral sex and wanted my bishop to advise me. I was so naive, I hadn't even heard of oral sex before marriage, and it seemed pretty bizarre to me. Clearly, some bishoply advice was in order. Well, he said, it's important to please your husband, in parens. Although it didn't occur to me at the time, I soon realized that pleasing the man was more important than pleasing the female. Then he added, but continue your prayer so that perhaps he can overcome this. I remember thinking, wait a minute, this puts me into an impossible bind. There must be something terribly wrong with oral sex if he has to overcome it. And yet, I was supposed to keep him happy. So I resigned myself to satisfying my husband orally, which also said to me that for the female to sin was acceptable if it made the husband happy and prevented him from otherwise sinning anyway. But the biggest problem was my bishop's advice was it didn't leave me free to enjoy this type of lovemaking with my husband. Oral sex for my husband absolutely not allowed. I was in quite a bind. At this stage, I was also asked if I wore my temple garments night and day. I hesitated, then sheepishly admitted that sometimes I didn't wear them all night. When the bishop asked how often this occurred, I replied, about twice a month. He then said to keep in touch with him on this to make sure it didn't get out of hand. Becoming free to enjoy a beautiful sexual union is the right of every young married couple. I should have been encouraged to explore new and pleasurable ways of enjoying lovemaking. I should have been told, sex is the greatest thing there is. Enjoy it. As long as you both enjoy something, go for it. Nope. Instead of being told about the joy of sex, I was told to pray for my husband to overcome his desire for oral gratification, to put up with his need, and be sure to put my garments back on as soon as we were through. In hindsight, the whole thing was so ludicrous. I have since apologized to my now ex-husband and explained to him my formal dilemma. At the time, naturally, I didn't tell him about my conversation with the bishop. Imagine the absurdity of a bishop coming between the sexual union of a wife and her husband. I know that my bishop had very good intentions and was following instructions, but it's such a shame that I lost all those years of sensuality and freedom because of the straight-laced instructions from leaders of the church who have no right to enter into my bedroom. If nothing else, at least I finally learned that lesson.
Thanks, Kirsten. Our next piece is by Lynn Anderson, who read this herself at the Salt Lake Symposium last summer. I'm very sad that I was not there and I missed it. But Lynn Anderson is a lifelong member. She's a graduate of BYU who served a French-speaking mission. She's married with three children, and she claims she is, quote, modest as the day is long. And they now live in France, which probably explains why she's not here. And it will be read by Lori Winterstrom. It's called Bare Naked Lady. Had such a thing existed, I would have been a leading candidate for Miss Pharisee when I was in my teens and early 20s. Yes, I made out with various boyfriends, but lust was confined to French kissing at most, and the two guys who tried to go further received, and I'm not kidding here, letters larded with scripture-laden moralistic exhortations about purity from yours truly. It may come as no surprise to those that those two relationships pretty well ended coincident to the receipt of those letters.
After my mission, I was one of many women who fell in with Chris, an emotional vampire, a guy who got lots of women to fall in love with him and who would dump the dames after he'd get them to reveal their feelings. Part of his strategy was to limit physical activity to one kiss per date, thereby minimizing the risk of his actually falling in love with the women he dated. This turd went so far as to talk marriage before he dumped me. Up to that point, each kiss was special, as was he for being so sensibly chaste. Although I nearly lost my virginity to an alumnus of my mission, I also dated a mission alumnus who was completely, and I mean completely, inexperienced. We had an off-again, on-again relationship that culminated in our being officially engaged for something like 55 minutes. And this despite the fact that the apex of our physical intimacy was holding hands. I confess that I still regret never having kissed him, but then again, such an act might have changed history altogether. We ended up marrying people who were better for us than we would have been for each other, and we are all of us, including his wife and my husband, still friends. After my mission, I had the completely unexpected and out-of-the-blue experience of falling in love with a woman. After several months of fighting our attraction to one another, we kissed, and then felt so incredibly guilty that we went immediately to our BYU bishop, who advised us not to live together and told us not to go to the temple for a month. We were lucky, given that these days kissing someone of the same sex is grounds for expulsion at BYU. My friend is still single, still active in the church, and I suspect still afraid of her feelings. I fared better. I fall more on the heterosexual end of the continuum and went on to get married, which I have been for nearly 20 years. I don't know how typical I really was, but I felt David and I were typical of most active LDS couples. My husband and I were both virgins when we married. We didn't seem to have any real sexual hang-ups for having been virgins to our mid-20s. We knew that we didn't have to mess with temple garments when having sex. Stories of other LDS people's newlywed hang-ups and misconceptions, no pun intended, astonished us. As with so many other women, I didn't discover masturbation until after I was married. Interestingly enough, the only time a bishop ever came close to asking me if I masturbated was just before I got married. But all he asked was if I touched my breasts when I showered. Oh, baby. Oh, baby. Talk about the blind leading the blind. I have to say that I do not miss temple-recommend interviews in the slightest. All of this history is simply preliminary to my main topic. David and I have been inactive for a few years now. I briefly dabbled with the kinds of adolescent behaviors that I had eschewed in my teens and discovered that the word of wisdom was totally ingrained. For one thing, it is well nigh impossible to acquire taste for alcohol at 40. And as for smoking, forget it. We both have made a few forays into what the French call la vie naturiste. Perhaps as a token of our rebellious spirits, we've experimented with nudism a little bit. When I say we, I mean just David and I, not our kids. Bless the World Wide Web, which makes it easy to find out where those who extol the buff hang out. We found a little camp in the northwest corner of Massachusetts, but when we arrived, it seemed clear to us that, for however snobby this will sound, we were just weren't blue-collar trailer park nudist types. So we wended our way to our Plan B site, a secluded stretch of riverbank in western Massachusetts. It was a lovely and liberating feeling to stretch out on a sun-warmed rocks and watch a flock of blue jays dart about. I didn't even know that blue jays came in flocks. We went to a more exposed and populated location in Vermont several weeks later, enduring the stares of speedboat owners and occupants and running into several naked hikers. Our final foray that first summer was to an established naturist camp northwest Connecticut with lovely facilities on a private lake. This is a family camp with very strict rules about behavior and decorum. Interestingly enough, the Muppeteer who plays Oscar the Grouch in Big Bird is supposedly a member of this colony. Let me just say that one has never truly lived nor truly played volleyball if one has not played it in the nude with a bunch of other nude people. From volleyball to our other excursions, I have discovered that, one, we are not among the beautiful people, but that, two, hardly anyone else is either. While I'm still a member of the clan of the flat-chested women, with apologies to Terry Tempest Williams, believe me, freely choosing to undress and mingle with similarly imperfect others represented gigantic progress in the way I felt about my body in, say, junior high. Who here doesn't recall, with loathing, being forced to take a shower after gym class? The daily mortification of comparing my underdeveloped self with the enviable bodies of my peers was hard to bear. Again, no pun intended. We stayed clothed until a lengthy trip to southern France, Spain, and Italy in the late summer / early fall of 1999, when David and I spent an afternoon at the enclosed Quartier Naturiste in the Mediterranean city of Agde, France. At its peak, the nudist colony hosts more than 30,000 nudists. After passing through an admission center, one can strip down and then live life quite normally as a nudist. There is a post office, cinema, grocery store, and so forth, patronized by people in various states of mostly undress. David and I were considerably paler than most of the Caucasians around. I think we stayed clothed all last year. Just a few weeks ago, however, David and I spent a few days in Provincetown on the tip of Cape Cod. Let me say that for most of my adult life, I was quite thin. So suddenly, I suddenly find myself roughly 50% heavier than my typical adult weight over the past 18 months or so has been most disconcerting. I totally hate the apron, the fold of flesh that sags below my navel, a product of torn muscles during my last pregnancy and a slowing thyroid. Until the test come back negative, I'm still very willing to blame Hashimoto's thyroiditis for my weight gain rather than bad eating habits. So this was the first time I was going to expose my larger self, mostly to myself and David. Given the locations where people go natural include long stretches of mostly deserted and sand dunes and beach. How did I feel about myself and this body? Well, I still would like to drop a good 30 pounds, that's for sure. But I realized, too, that I wasn't, that David and I were no longer going naked as a means of showing our freedom from the constraints of Mormonism, if that ever has been our motive. But rather, we were going naked because it felt good and right to feel the sun and the wind and the water on our bare flesh. Naturism isn't something I do to shock my conservative parents and siblings and friends, nor am I inclined toward exhibitionism. But in private or among the like-minded, going naked is a way to remember the physical creatures that we are and a way to combat society's loud insistence that the totality of our bodies is simply a framework for our genitalia. And it's a way to come to terms with the images we have of ourselves. But mostly, going naked just feels good.
The next piece is one that I wrote. And I love Janet's little blurb about me that she wrote. She says, Jane Ann Peterson is an intellectual property lawyer living in Portland, Oregon. She's married to David Olson, and between the two of them, they created a wee wonder and heartthrob named Anders. And that was him, back there, the fact that you've been hearing talking this whole time. My piece is called I Was a Born Again Virgin, Diary of a Mormon Vagina. I'm pretty proud of my vagina lately. I mean, who knew that an essentially closed space could pass an object the size of a cantaloupe and survive to copulate again? The fact that billions of women had done it before made it no less miraculous to me. But I should start at the beginning. This may shock some of you, but I had a fairly normal Mormon upbringing. Not normal Mormon, perhaps, but since for all I know, the typical Mormon upbringing is nothing like mine, but normal and Mormon. We attended church every week without fail, had family home evening every Monday night, said family prayers twice a day, and read the scriptures over breakfast. We also were taught from the beginning to use regular anatomical terms when referring to our body parts. Not to say that we were completely accurate. For us girls in particular, the term vagina was understood as referring to the whole front crotchal area. I didn't spend a whole lot of time exploring down there, and it wasn't until many years later, maybe in sex ed, that I realized that there were three openings rather than two. Ah, sex ed. In Oregon, formal sex education started in fifth grade and was pretty thorough. But informal sex education started much earlier. I somehow mostly escaped playing doctor. I think the only time it was suggested, my mom discovered us and intervened before anyone got naked. But in second grade, Jennifer Fair, who's the daughter of Sue Emmett, whom some of you probably know, a third grader who also happened to be in my ward, whispered a rudimentary description of sex in my ear. The man sticks his penis in the lady's vagina. I was incredulous. I pondered this piece of information all day, and that evening shared it with my brother as we were getting undressed for our bath, and my mom was out of the room. My brother was a first grader. He was a year younger than I was. No way, really? Do you think we should try it? Nah. In any case, compared to the shocking discovery that reproduction of our species was accomplished in such a bizarre manner, formal sex ed, which for girls was mostly about menstruation and how to manage it, was plain old boring. When I turned 12, two things happened. I got my period and started going to Mutual, not necessarily in that order. For the next 10 years, up to and including my years at BYU, which in so many ways was Academy for Girls Revisited, I and my cohort were subjected to an at least annual chastity talk. Bad science, sexist claptrap, false doctrine, and a healthy fillip of guilt on top. What more could a girl ask? At one BYU installment of the lecture series, given by the bishop of our ward during Sunday Relief Society, he actually delineated, I mean, he could have had a chart, the distinction between light petting, heavy petting, and very heavy petting. And heaven knows what I would have done without that precious piece of knowledge. Does anyone else remember those funnel-shaped diagrams with commitment controlled by the boy on one side and sexual involvement controlled by the girl on the other? It's a very slippery slope. Somebody was really into those. They kind of looked like diagrams of women's reproductive organs. Yeah, vagina. Totally looked like that. Because, of course, we all know that boys are incapable of controlling their sexual urges. They're like an avalanche once they get going, and it's all your fault if you don't stop them early. Don't even get me started on how mad that made and continues to make me the fact that grown adults who should know better apparently believe in it lock, stock, and barrel boggles my mind. I'm also quite certain that at least one Mutual era lecture, we got a variant of the chewed gum / crushed rose / licked cake / nailed board object lesson. I'm sure every girl in my generation got it at least once. Please tell me this excruciatingly wrong-headed practice has been eradicated. The fact is, through all of high school and college and a couple of years after, my understanding of these issues was almost entirely academic, as opportunities to be unchaste were hardly beating the door down. There were a couple opportunities, that is, notably Scott, a one-night stand whose right hand seemed to have a magnetic attraction to my left breast, and who was surprisingly skillful at manipulating one of his legs between mine. Martin, the sculpted ivory English computer geek with whom I had a crushingly romantic two-week fling in Paris. And Hagen, the mysterious man of mysterious origins who discovered me singing for gelato money on the streets of Florence and invited me to go to Turkey with him to celebrate his 50th birthday. All these opportunities went unseized, and other than the fleeting contact with Scott's magnetic hand, even my breasts remained virgins. Then when I was 24, things changed. I fell in love. He was even more inexperienced than I was. I think he had made out with one other woman after I had met him and started to like him, who in a rare moment of cosmic justice gave him mono. Whereas I had made out with a half dozen or so men, the same number exactly as had tried. In our utterly besotted state, I'm a little lazy. In our utterly besotted state, we set about pushing the boundaries of chaste behavior further and further. There were a lot of firsts that summer and fall. I still remember the look of absolute rapture on his face the first time he almost reverently cupped my breasts in his hands, through clothing no less, and each new foray into the taboo heightened our excitement. However, the final frontier, insertion of tab A into slot B, remained unbreached, and we unsatisfied. Our frustration was exquisite. 8 months later, I had moved to New York City, and we had broken up. I spent most of the following few years in the second half of my 20s dating a few non-Mormon men and one highly experienced and much younger Mormon one who graced me one afternoon with a true quadruple orgasm. Having once faced what had seemed the ultimate temptation, intercourse with someone I truly loved and thought I was going to marry, and having resisted it, I found it increasingly easy to keep drawing the line just short of penetration. I became the world's most sexually experienced technical virgin. ever ready for and never tiring of passionate kissing, fevered bumping and grinding, and naked rolling around. I built up an impressive collection of sex books and earned a reputation by habitually giving silk lingerie as a shower gift and the joy of sex as a wedding gift. For my sister, I nestled the pocket-size edition in a crock pot. I wasn't obsessed, per se, but it would be fair to say that I was sex-focused. And then I got married. Which is not to say that I no longer enjoy sex, it just no longer absorbs me the way it once did. Partly I think it's because the thrill of the forbidden is gone. But I think I'm also at least a little disillusioned. You see, everything I'd ever heard or read before I got married always talked about intercourse as the last and best part of sex, and everything else was mere foreplay. Even in writing by women, vaginal penetration was always the grand finale of any sexual escapade. And in those silly little charts in the chastity talks, which looked so much like vaginas, it was a linear progression of sinfulness from French kissing through petting, through oral sex, and ending in intercourse. So naturally I expected that pleasure would follow the same linear progression. I had had a very, very satisfying premarital non-penetrative sex life, and I imagined that married sex that included intercourse would be positively mind-blowing. So you can understand that when my wedding night arrived and intercourse not only didn't send me to the pinnacle of pleasure, but was actually affirmatively uncomfortable, I was a bit bummed. What a letdown! All that anticipation, all that buildup, all that frustration, and instead of an explosion of ecstasy, oh, I got a slow fizzle. And there was no way I could have known beforehand. Maybe it would have been better had I been less experienced. Maybe then I would have been so thrilled with any kind of sexual contact that I wouldn't have noticed that intercourse for me wasn't as fulfilling as it apparently was for Judith Krantz and Erica Jong. But maybe not. I think a lot of sexual dysfunction among Mormons originates not in discomfort with their sexuality, but in disappointment. Nothing could live up to the kind of hype generated by all those years of chastity talks. Fortunately, sex got better as I learned to deal with my disappointment and as my body adjusted to the bizarre manner of reproduction in our species. We soon adopted a typical newlywed schedule of sex, something like 5 days a week. I'm talking about my sex life. And my father-in-law, my sister-in-law are sitting right here. And then when we started trying to get me pregnant, we were on a strict every other day schedule. Of course, when that time is nothing more than a faint memory now. I was not one of those lucky women whose sexual appetites go into overdrive during pregnancy. First, I was nauseated, and then I was bulky and awkward, and I couldn't stand any pressure on my abdomen even before I started to have a discernible belly. And things just felt different down there, you know, different texture, different consistency, and a different sensitivities. Blech. And then there was childbirth and more disillusionment. I like to think I'm a pretty capable person. I generally don't spend much time worrying about whether or not I can do something. I just do it. And usually I succeed. I was as prepared as I could have been. I read and studied multiple books on pregnancy and childbirth, attended natural childbirth classes, did prenatal yoga, and visualized my ideal labor and birth. I arranged to be surrounded in the delivery room by strong women, David's mother and grandmother, my mother and sister. I picked a midwife and a hospital who would be supportive of my birthing choices. What I didn't count on was an uncooperative baby. Anders stubbornly presented himself with his face to the side, not to the back, as is more normal, causing labor pains in both front and back instead of just one or the other. I ended up having the epidural I had wished to avoid. Then I pushed and pushed and pushed, and he would just not move beyond a certain point. The pressure was unbelievably uncomfortable. All my birth attendants stared hopefully at my distended vulva for over too long wee morning hours while I pushed with all my might in several positions, hoping to see more than just a little sliver of head peeking out. It's like, oh, I can see the head! An hour later, I can see the head! Very frustrating. Finally, I vomited all the water I had dutifully been sipping throughout my labor, and he turned and came out, his hours of misdirection molded into his misshapen skull. Knob on the side. Trust my child to be so busy patting himself on the back that he is born with his arm still wrapped around his neck, his elbow making a small tear in his mommy's perineum and needing a few stitches. Which brings me back to the present, or at least the present of 1 year ago, and the title of this piece. One of my girlfriends, who also had a baby recently, said that the first postpartum intercourse was like a medical procedure. Even after a few months of healing, intercourse was burning and painful, much worse than on our wedding night. But just like in the first few months of our marriage, matters have improved with time and gentle practice. Maybe by this time next year, right now, when Anders will be sleeping through the night, we'll be back to where we once were. As a postscript, Anders started sleeping through the night when he was 13 months old last September. And, you know, I don't feel like it will ever be the same, ever. Having children just changes everything completely. But I have to say, we'll never quite probably get back to the quantity we had as newlyweds, but the quality has improved. Thank you very much. Our last piece will be, if I can find it in here, it's a piece by Holly Welker called Bearing My Sexual Testimony. Holly Welker is not here today. She has a PhD in English Literature from the University of Iowa. She has written a book entitled The Rib Cage about her experiences as a missionary in Taiwan. I think excerpts from her book appeared in a recent issue of Sunstone. It was a very good read. She still has a testimony, she says, but it's not of the truthfulness of the Mormon Church. So her piece will be read, again, by Kirsten Wald. It's called Bearing with E in parentheses, My Sexual Testimony.
Shouldn't a Mormon version of the vagina monologues be called the vagina testimony meeting? I don't subscribe to the doctrines of Mormonism anymore, but I was raised in the church and I know its rhetoric of performance. So let me say this. My womb is so full, I want to lie before you and bear my testimony, trying to express some of what I feel. I am happy to participate in this project of claiming the sexuality of Mormon women as sacred spaces. But I'd like to ask, what does space mean? Are we talking geometry, as in the infinite extension of the three-dimensional field of everyday life? Are we referring to sufficient freedom from external pressure to develop or explore one's needs, interests, and individuality, as in, I need my space? Or are we talking about a blank or empty area? I'd like to cast my vote for the freedom to explore our needs, interests, and individuality, but I have a feeling that first we'll have to carve out a blank or empty area in which to claim, quote, sufficient freedom from external pressure, unquote, to make that exploration. My womb is indeed full, metaphorically full of attitudes, ideas, and creative projects I hope to birth, literally full of blood and tissue. My stomach, however, is relatively empty right now. My stomach might be empty, but even at this moment, I don't think of it primarily as a space. The same goes for my esophagus, my intestines, my bladder, my lungs. I think of them as organs with specific jobs to do, though it is their spaciousness rather than their density that enables them to do their jobs. Nor do I think of my ears as spaces, even though I'm aware of their cavities every time a normally empty space within them fills with water. But the rest of the time, my ears are to me a center of sensory input and a source of my understanding of the world. I don't define my mouth as a space either. Instead, it's another source of sensory information, a site of pleasure, a locus of communication. Should I think of my vagina as a space? I know that in the male world, a vagina, mine included, is defined primarily as a space, an empty area. But unless you're giving birth, spaciousness is not a vaginal virtue. Tightness is what makes for a good vagina, and exercise is prescribed to tighten a loose vagina up. The vagina, spacious, tight, or otherwise, is not the only organ of female sexuality. Why, aside from the fact that it is a receptacle for a penis, is the vagina so often the focus of discussions of female sexuality? The vagina is a deep subject, but I would like to broaden this discussion, add a few contours. I would like to say the word pussy. I would like to say the word cunt. These words, unmentionable in many circumstances, refer not to the vagina, but to the vulva, which includes the major and minor labia, the clitoris, and the vestibule of the vagina. I need these words to help me understand another question. What is the female equivalent of phallic? It can't be vaginal, which sounds as clinically medical as penile or testicular. lots of words. It better not be hysteric, which, derived from the Greek word of for womb, has too many negative connotations. Phallic refers not only to genitalia, but to the symbolic power of masculinity. What is the female equivalent? What word refers not only to genitalia, but to the symbolic power of femaleness? If such a word already exists, I don't think I've heard it. So I propose a word. Vulvic. V-U-L-V-I-C. I want to invoke the power to unsettle present in the word cunt. I want a word involving not just a sacred space, but a sacred presence. And what, after all, does sacred mean? How does it relate to sexuality, particularly within a Mormon context? I think most Mormons would recoil slightly at the idea that sex is dedicated to or set apart for the worship of deity. I think it's more likely that in Mormondom, sex is dedicated or devoted exclusively to a single use, purpose, or person. That use being procreation and that person being one's spouse, which is why the church condemns sex outside of a monogamous heterosexual marriage. And even though the church sanctions the use of birth control, sex that doesn't result in the birth of a child is supposed to be like practice for sex that does. There's another meaning of sacred for Mormons, one not listed in the American Heritage Dictionary, a meaning that comes from our being told that the temple ceremony is not to be discussed, not because it's secret, because it's sacred. And that meaning is pertaining to something outside the bounds of sanctioned discourse, pertaining to an action that can be performed but not scrutinized or analyzed. But I hope we were working toward a view of the range of women's sexuality as sacred in the sense of worthy of respect and venerable, that even in its sacredness, it remains open to discussion and scrutiny. I bear testimony to the power of words, even in sexuality. It took me forever to teach my body to have orgasms, to see sex as something more than merely a pragmatic bodily function. And in order to do it, I had to learn a bunch of P words. The first being pretend, the second being power. Nowadays, I'm trying to concentrate on pleasure, passion, play, and possibility, having discarded the words prude, perfunctory, promiscuity. Along the way, there has been please, and pleading, and pretty, and pray, and prick, and penis, and pussy, and pushy, and pressure, and painful. Unfortunately, there has been very little patience. I truly needed to learn these words because I was one of the most sexually inexperienced 25-year-olds you'll ever find. I lost my virginity shortly before my 26th birthday, not because I was overwhelmed by passion, but because I felt I had to rectify the fact that I knew less about sex than the undergrads with whom I taught poetry writing. How was I supposed to lead discussion of a poem about a blowjob or an orgasm when I had no first-hand information about them? As you might imagine, given the circumstances, what I did learn from having sex was a big disappointment. It wasn't until months after I became sexually active that I figured out how to masturbate, which I needed to do since the sex afforded no gratification. I had actually been trying to masturbate for a couple of years. Sometimes I find myself very aroused, but I could never figure out how to satisfy that arousal. The tip-off was a brief mention in a fashion magazine article that many women were embarrassed by how unenlightened and unliberated their fantasies were. Fantasies? You mean people think about things while they masturbate instead of just stroking a body part? You mean sex is an intellectual experience as well as a physical one? Well, I came up with my own array of fantasies, most of them as embarrassingly unenlightened and unliberated as those that had first clued me in, specifically rape fantasies and variations of a theme of male domination and female submission, part of the sexual repertoire of a culture that produced A Clockwork Orange and The Last Tango in Paris. After a good 6 or 7 years of that, I decided I no longer wanted to find any gratification in a scenario that involved sacrificing my power to someone else's pleasure. And I decided I would only masturbate to happy fantasies, fantasies where everyone is glad to be there, is treated with respect for the duration, and goes home happy, the fantasies that would most please me if they happened in real life. I've been told a time or two, as I've tried to explain my approach, that I should loosen up, that I sound awfully uptight, awfully vanilla, but I'd like to know, what's wrong with focusing on good-natured, generous, joyous sex? I can think of worse things, and I say this, I will not be a sexual cipher. While I might claim my own sexual space, I will not be a space for someone else. I will not be the stage on which someone else performs his own pleasure. I am happy to be a sexual partner. But whether I am in a partnership or alone, I insist on being a sexual presence. In closing, I would like to say that I know that ethical and moral sex is possible outside the bounds of heterosexual marriage. I know that masturbation is every bit as much a God-given gift as sex with a partner. I know that we all have the right to pleasure, though none of us has the right to pleasure that comes at the cost of someone else's suffering. I know that my life is richer as a result of knowing these things, and I'm grateful for this chance to bear my sexual testimony, my seximony. I say this in the name of all that is holy and good. Amen.
Amen.
We're about out of time, but I just wanted to take a couple of minutes. I talked to Janet the other day about this. And we love this session. We love having created this thing. But most of these pieces that we read today are a year old, or at least 6 months old. And what we want to do is try and inspire you to continue this. It needs to be an ongoing thing. Obviously, my piece was already dated, and I'm sure the others were as well. This needs to be an ongoing thing. We need to kind of spread the word, infect other women with the desire to tell their stories. Because as I was thinking about people that I wanted to ask to read today, and I was thinking of my sister-in-law and of my mother-in-law who was supposed to be here, and other wonderful friends, and I thought, well, yeah, they'd be great readers, but I'd be so much more interested in hearing their story than in hearing them read someone else's story. So I would encourage you all to write your stories, even if you don't share it with Janet and me to make it a part of this collection, which we would eventually like to have published. Share your story. It can be anonymously. But write it down. And thank you very much for coming. I was ready to close, you know.
Unders!
Who to send it to?
To me or to Janet? Okay.
Maybe you
want to
take email
addresses down? Yes. I'd love to. Janet Kincaid's address, probably the best one would be J.M. Kincaid, K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at AOL.com. My address is Jane Anchovy at attbi.com. Jane Anchovy, C-H-O-V-Y at the end of J-A-N-E-A-N-N-E. And this is Anders.